The Speaker of the Nova Scotia House of Assembly grants permission to record the televised proceedings of the legislature for use in schools and for other purposes, such as private study, research, review, or newspaper summary. Television and radio broadcasters may make use of recorded excerpts of the televised proceedings in their news or public affairs programs for the purpose of fair and accurate reports of proceedings. Program material may not be used for political party advertising, election campaigns, or any other politically partisan activity. Program material may not be edited for use in promotional material by any political party or other organization, and may not be used in any edited form that could mislead or misinform an audience or viewer, or which does not present a balanced portrayal of the proceedings in the House. Video program material may only be used with its original audio components, and no other audio material may be added to video material used. Any other commercial use or rebroadcast of these proceedings requires the express written approval of the Speaker.
Good morning. I'd like to bring the meeting to order. The usual reminders regarding cell phones and with our mics. I think we've said that enough times here. Everybody understands all that stuff. And I would like to start the meeting with Mr. Ramey. Start with introductions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, everybody. Gary Ramey, MLA Lunenburg West.
Good morning. Matt Wynott, MLA Hammonds Plains, Upper Sackville.
Good morning, Sid Prest, MLA for the Eastern Shore, and I'm filling in for Brian Scobar.
Good morning, Clary McKinnon, MLA, Pictou East.
Good morning and welcome, Howard Epstein, MLA for Halifax, Shebucto.
Good morning, Kelly Regan, MLA for Bedford, Birch Cove, in for Andrew Younger, MLA, Dartmouth East.
Darlene Henry, committee clerk.
Al Horgan, Deputy Auditor General.
Jacques Lapointe, Auditor General.
Terry Spicer, Assistant Auditor General.
Evangeline Coleman Sad, Assistant Auditor General.
Thank you very much. And I'd like to welcome everybody this morning. And we'll start with Mr. Lapointe. If you would, I'd like to start with an opening statement.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, as you know, my spring 2013 report was tabled with the House of Assembly on May 22nd. It was my second report in 2013 and covered audit work completed by my office in the winter of this year. I'm pleased to have the opportunity to discuss it with you today. So with me today are Deputy Auditor General Alan Horgan and Assistant Auditor General Terry Spicer and Evangeline Coleman-Sad. Terry and Evangeline were each responsible for certain chapters in the report. I'm sure that among us we can answer any questions that you may have. Before we begin, I want to acknowledge here the hard work, the dedication, and professionalism of my staff. It is through their efforts that we are able to provide assurance and advice to the House of Assembly on the operations of government. I also wish to express my appreciation to the many public servants in departments and agencies whose cooperation was essential to the success of our audits. There are four chapters in the report, in addition to the introduction. We make 76 recommendations, all intended to correct operational weaknesses and improve departmental and agency efficiency and effectiveness. I'll briefly mention the topics that we cover. In Chapter 2, we follow up on our recommendations made in performance audits from 2007 to 2010. We continue to find, with some exceptions, a low level of implementation of our recommendations across government. This means there is an inadequate commitment by management generally to correcting deficiencies in their operations identified in our audits. Chapter 3 deals with certain aspects of the child welfare program at community services. This is an important area dealing with children at risk. We found some areas of the program to be adequate, but there are weaknesses in the program that need to be addressed. In Chapter 4, we report that the operations of TIR's mechanical branches at Miller Lake and Truro are deficient in many respects, and oversight is poor. These are operations with significant cash flows and inventories, and the risk of losses through error and theft is high. Our last chapter discusses our audit of travel and expense claims in 8 government agencies. We found numerous control weaknesses in these agencies and recommended that all agencies be required to review and tighten their procedures for expense claims. In addition to the report, Mr. Chair, I also hope to have the opportunity later this morning to discuss with the committee my letter to you of May 17, in which I propose some actions this committee can take to actively promote the timely implementation of audit recommendations. Now, with that, Mr. Chair, it will be our pleasure to answer any questions the committee may have on our report.
Thank you, Mr. LaPointe. I'll start, Mr. Regan. You have 20 minutes.
Thank you very much, and I'd like to thank you all for coming in today. I'd just like to talk, first of all, about accountability and process. And from page 9 of the report, you identify that the government's overall implementation rate of our performance audit recommendations is poor. They're not taking adequate measures to correct operational deficiencies identified in audit findings, a low level of commitment to implementing recommendations. At this point, only 41% of your 2010 recommendations have been implemented, and overall only 62% of recommendations from 2007 to 2010 have been implemented. Once a recommendation is made to a department and accepted, what's the usual procedure for addressing that recommendation within the department?
Yeah, well, what we always do, in fact, with our recommendations is first we clear all the findings and conclusions in our report with departments to make sure that they have no disagreements with what we found. We get them to state in their responses whether or not they accept our recommendations and intend to implement, and in 99% of the time they do. In fact, in this case, I'd say 99% is about the right number. So we then leave it to departments to take action, usually at the managerial level, to begin the process of implementation. In some cases, they've started this well before the audit is finished. And that certainly, for instance, isn't the case with TIR this time. So then it becomes the deputy ministers and senior management's task to drive the changes within the department or the CEO's job and the board of directors if it's an agency.
So do you think that's actually happening, that deputy ministers are, in fact, overseeing it, or is it being delegated? Sorry about the voice. Allergy season. That it's being delegated to other staff members.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to say because we don't follow the exact process. I would expect in a normal organization that it would be delegated. I would expect the head of the organization to simply provide the instructions to staff to take this action and then delegate it down to the appropriate levels to deal with it. And I think that happens in some form or other like that in all departments.
Okay. Does the minister take any role in overseeing that recommendations are completed, for example?
That I can't say. I don't know how that... We're not privy to those meetings within the department, so I couldn't tell you the extent of their involvement.
So if there's a recommendation... It seems to me that we have a lot of departments where things just aren't happening, where the departments are not completing the various recommendations, and yet they've said they agree with them. I'm just wondering, which would you prefer? If they disagree with something, would you prefer they just said, look, we're not going to do that and this is why, rather than saying, yes, we agree with it, and then not doing anything?
Well, we do specifically ask departments tell us in their response whether they agree or not. And they have obviously a legitimate right to not agree with what we recommend. The fact that they might not disagree with our findings or conclusions doesn't mean that our solution to the problem is what they would agree to. So it's perfectly right to do so. And occasionally that happens. But for the most part, they are indicating agreement. My feeling is then that they must agree that it's right to do, certainly at the high level in which we're discussing it with the department. And my feeling is that if you do feel that there is a deficiency in your operations, and you agree it's there, and you agree that it should be corrected, then you have a managerial responsibility to deal with it.
Do you have any idea what role the Premier's office and central agencies like Policy and Priorities or Treasury Board, what role they have in making sure that recommendations are completed and setting priorities?
No, I have no knowledge of a role at that level.
In terms of completion verification, your report cites that about 25% of completed recommendations by departments are actually incomplete. I'm wondering, can you explain how do you assess this?
Yes, well, we do a fairly in-depth review of the individual recommendations, but what I think I would like to do is ask Terry Spicer to give you a little more detail on exactly how that works.
Mr. Spicer.
Thank you. The process basically starts with management's self-assessment of the status of the recommendations. So those recommendations that they've identified as being complete, we will then look for some sort of verification that we have some comfort that it is complete. So depending on the recommendation, if the recommendation, as an example, might have been to put a control in place, well, we would look at that as an example, whether there's been a policy adjustments to assess whether to address those controls. We will even do some testing to see whether those controls are in fact have been implemented. So we will basically go and look at whatever verification documentation. We will even interview staff to get a feel for whether those things are complete or not.
So where the disputed, you say about 25% of completed recommendations by departments, in fact, were not completed. And I'm just wondering, were these errors in reporting, disagreements about what constitutes completed, or were there cases of intentional misreporting?
Again, I think I'll ask Mr. LaPointe Spicer to talk to that.
Mr. Spicer?
Thank you. It's hard to speak to whether there was any intent to misreport. I can say, though, based on our review, we in most, if not all, cases, will send back and discuss why we feel the recommendations are not complete. And again, in the vast majority of cases, management will agree that yes, you know, you're correct that those haven't been completely addressed. So. I think you would need to ask management, I think, in the various departments as to get further clarification on that.
So just to speak to process, did you take a sample or confirm all of your recommendations? Do you go through and look at each individual one?
We will look at 100% of those that they've assessed as complete.
All right.
We do not look at those that they've assessed as not complete.
Okay. So the Department of Community Services had a completion rate of 25% of the recommendations your office made in 2010. So that would be 25% of the ones
that would be 25% of the total recommendations.
Okay. All right. In terms of status reporting, the government now issues updates on the status of their work on your recommendations, and I'm just wondering what kind of confidence we can have in those updates, because I think we've been in meetings before where there was some disagreement about that.
Mr. LaPointe?
Yes, as I have said, I do commend the government for, you know, actually reporting on its on its progress in implementing these recommendations. As a concept, it's very good accountability. The problem arises with the reliability of the information being presented, and I've commented in prior, at least one prior year, that I believe management has a responsibility to ensure that the cabinet receives accurate information so that they report accurate information. We can extrapolate that there will be a 25% error rate in the information provided in that status update simply on the basis of what we found in the part that we looked at. That means that when you look at any particular recommendation, you know, the chance of it being the status as complete being correct, you know, there's a very good chance of it being wrong. So you can't tell looking at it how accurate it is. So I've labeled it as unreliable for that purpose. But I have also, you know, recommended to Treasury Board office that someone in senior management take a responsibility for providing cabinet with accurate information, and they have told me they disagreed with that recommendation and would not implement it.
Okay. So what's the procedure for departments to report their progress and then publish the updates? Do they give you a heads up before they publish their updates? I'm assuming that's not the case if they're putting things online there that you disagree with.
No, the update is prepared from the status updates that are in this so-called Tagger system, the same one that we look at, in fact. So that it is prepared from that Tagger information by senior management, and I believe in Treasury Board office.
So you don't see those. Reports on their you don't see those progress reports before they put them up and indicate that they're compliant.
No, we're not involved in that process at all.
Okay, all right. So, do you know how many officials sign off on the implementation and completion of recommendations? Is it frontline workers? Is it program administrators? I'm just sort of wondering who makes the determination within a given department that something is actually complete.
I'll ask Mr. Spicer to speak to that.
Okay.
And actually,
Mr. Spicer?
I really don't know how each particular department does that. I think it, as Mr. LaPointe mentioned earlier, it's probably different at each department as to who and how that's done. Our review of this really focuses on specific recommendations and doing the work around those. We don't really look at the process, you know, around that.
All right. It seems to me that therefore these status reports are touched by many hands, and they're, ministers right on down. I'm just wondering who's accountable for the veracity or the truthiness of these so-called status reports. I mean, if it's the department self-reporting, and I'm just wondering, is there anybody within those department who is tasked with actually making sure what they're saying is accurate?
Mr. LaPointe?
Yeah, we don't really have any good way of knowing. We did recommend last year, in fact, that Treasury Board office take responsibility for that, for ensuring that the information presented to them from the departments is accurate, and institute a quality assurance system to make sure that the level of accuracy is acceptable. That's the recommendation they did not accept. But we felt that the responsibility for the reliability and accuracy of that information needed to reside at a central agency somewhere, and that someone needed to take responsibility for it rather than just leaving it up to individual departments to do whatever they pleased.
So that was the Government Audit Committee? Am I correct?
No. The recommendation we made was to Treasury Board office,
mm-hmm.
and our feeling was that it was up to them to decide who would have responsibility for this, but that a quality assurance system had to be put in place in which someone takes responsibility for it, as opposed to just compiling the information.
So who would be, is there anyone in particular within Treasury Board that would be in charge of making sure that these were accurate. I'm just trying to find out who would be the people involved.
Do we know? I can't say with certainty, you know, who within the department is responsible for compiling this information at any point in time. Beyond knowing that it goes through Treasury Board office at some point, necessarily it has to go through them to get to cabinet to be sent out as a status update. But this is a compilation exercise, and I'm not really sure I can say anyone has real responsibility for any of it beyond just, you know, gathering and sending out requests for updates and gathering the information in and putting it together in a spreadsheet.
So if I could put it in a nutshell, what you're looking for is accountability from the departments, and we want to make sure that, in fact, there's somebody who is tasked with actually finding out whether these reports from departments are actually accurate, because it's an easy thing to claim, and there doesn't seem to be any independent oversight, I guess is what I'm saying.
I'd say that's accurate. The recommendation we have is that someone take that oversight role and take the responsibility for it, rather than have us go back and look at it and report. I would rather, frankly, that wasn't necessary, that we had sufficient confidence in the accuracy of these numbers that it wasn't worth us going back to take a look at it. And that, you know, if all we did was report that it was accurate to within 5%, there really wouldn't be any need for us to be repeating this kind of thing in this chamber.
I'm just wondering, does your office spend a lot of time going back and verifying the accuracy of these reports? Because it would seem to me that mm-hmm. if you're doing that, then you're not spending time doing sort of a primary focus of your office.
Well, that is part of the issue. We do spend a considerable amount of time doing this, and we are going back and looking at recommendations going back several years. Now, we've decided to cap that at about 5 years now and assume that if it hasn't been done by in this year, 2007, we'll assume it's not going to be done and quit tracking it. But it is a time-consuming effort on the part of our office, and it's only necessary because there are issues in it. If we knew that someone in government was taking this role of tracking and ensuring reliability and accuracy, and if someone was taking a more active role in simply ensuring, you know, a more timely, you know, and rigorous implementation, so that we weren't going back several years. After you go back two or three, you find it basically done, and there's nothing more to do. We would have, frankly, a considerable amount more time to conduct audits.
Thank you. I'd like to just move on to your most recent report. Community services, at 3.16, you stated that the criteria were developed specifically for this engagement. These objectives and criteria were discussed with and accepted as appropriate by senior management of the department. So I'm just wondering, who would have had final sign-off on this criteria development process? Would it have been the deputy minister?
Well, that's a fairly standard approach that we use, and the final sign-off on the criteria that we use would be me, that we determine what we audit against. We determine the audit objectives and what criteria we use to audit it with, to audit to. We discuss these with the organization being audited, mm-hmm. and we try to obtain agreement from them that these are appropriate, and in most of the cases we do, and there's always some discussion back and forth, but they originate from our office.
So you come with your list of what you're planning to look at the criteria, mm-hmm. and they say, well, we disagree with that, and you go back and forth a bit.
That's right.
It's not a surprise to them when you go in. They know what you're going to be looking at?
Oh, yes, they certainly do. We discuss the audits with the audited organization, from the very early stages, from the planning stage, all the way through, right to the end when we're discussing our findings.
Okay, so prior to the audit, the department would have had a complete understanding of what you were going in to look at and what you were about to do, and they would have accepted it as appropriate.
Yes. Now, they don't always accept all of our recommendations, or they sometimes are non-committal. It's not a requirement of our audits that we get departments to agree on what we're doing, but as a general rule, that's what happens.
Okay. And this doesn't just happen with community services, just to be clear. It's with all departments. That's your procedure when you're going in, right?
That's our standard practice.
With regard to manuals within DCS, you found inconsistencies and confusion over interpretation. And these manuals aren't new. So my question is, any idea why? I mean, and why these wouldn't have been identified in the past?
I'll ask Ms. Coleman-Saad to answer your question.
Okay. Ms. Coleman-Saad.
Thank you. I think it speaks to the fact that the department doesn't have a regularly scheduled review process for their manuals. Over time, processes change, forms change, the practices out in the field change, and I think the manuals are not always being updated to be entirely reflective of those. And that's one of the reasons why we recommended that there be a regular review of the manuals to see if an update is required or not, because sometimes an update may not be required, but it's still important for departments to do that check on a regular basis.
Okay, and there are similar, there are similar findings of confusion over policies throughout the report, including on page 41, where you state that staff noted confusion regarding which policies applied. And at 3.59, we noted confusion among management and staff concerning screening requirements for kinship homes. Are you aware of, or did you find in the course of your discussions, instances of staff...
Order, please. Unfortunately, your time has expired. Mr. McMaster.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my first reaction when I saw the report and saw the high percentage of recommendations that were never acted upon by various departments, I thought about how I'm driving up to Halifax every week for public accounts, and we're trying to be constructive, trying to uncover things in departments. Hopefully the goal is to make things better for people. I had someone last week, she is dealing with maintenance enforcement issues where she's trying to get her ex-spouse to support her and her child. She works, but of course she has a child. And so I asked her to take a look. I showed her a link to a previous public accounts meeting that we had on the subject, just for her interest, just to see that, you know, we do actually question things from time to time to try to make them better. And she sent me a note back that she was kind of amused that, you know, she didn't see anything was accomplished at the end of the meeting, and understandably so. I mean, we don't expect things to be solved inside our meetings here. But I guess I raised that point just to show that these decisions that departments are making do affect people. And what we try to do here in these meetings, and what your office is trying to do, is really make things better for the province. So I guess I put that on the record as an example of somebody who is, I'm trying to give them some insight into what we're trying to do, and if things aren't getting changed through our work here, then we need to address those who are avoiding making things better. I'm going to raise one example today, and this one has a strong interest for me because it was related to the area I represent, the pensioners at New Page. Went through an awful scenario where they, two major things happened. One, there was an error in their bridging benefits, so many of them were sent letters saying they could owe anywhere from $40,000 to $60,000. These people are retired. They're now on fixed incomes. And their fixed income, being their pension, in some cases dropped by upwards of 40%. And I know that the Labor and Workforce Development Pension Regulation was here back in 2008, and I had a chance to look over that was before I was elected, but I had a chance to look over what went on that day, and I shouldn't say what went on that day, because this was the report that the Auditor General's office did at the time. And I'm just raising this because this is, while it affected my area, this affects a lot of Nova Scotians going forward. If we're not getting pension regulation done right, The division is responsible for to supervise 495 plans with a total membership over 100,000 people. So that's one in every four working Nova Scotians. Their job is to safeguard entitlements to benefits promised under pension plans. And I'm going to try to stop talking and give you a chance to... I apologize for the length of this, but the duties include reviewing plan administrator annual filings, investigating plan member complaints, and providing information and support to pensioners. So this is an issue that affects one in four working Nova Scotians, roughly. At the time, the office, the Auditor General's office, had indicated that the systems and processes in place were not adequate, and there was some question whether they were the plans are being properly monitored and in compliance with the Act. So the whole reason we have an Act is to protect pensioners, so that people are paying into a pension they know they're going to get what they're promised. So the Pension Regulation Division did come back, and they said that they were pretty cooperative. But I do want to highlight the point that that the Auditor General made at the time, which was if the pension plan annual information return is incorrect, the superintendent's ability to provide oversight is compromised and pensioners' benefits could be at risk. And what happened? Well, in the case of New Page, their benefits were at risk because there was a bridging benefit error that was never discovered in the reports that were being submitted to government that went on for years. And that had a real impact on people because they received letters saying they owe $40,000 to $60,000. And also, in support of pensioners, when they were asked to make a decision about allowing early retirements within the plan and allowing solvency to be increased from 5 years to 10 years, those two factors, along with market decline, were the result of their pensions dropping by upwards of 40%, because those two things created a lot of strain on the plan at a time when it was already had dropped due to the market. So I guess I wanted to make that point that there is an example of where your office did its job to try to highlight the deficiencies, but they weren't necessarily corrected. And my question is, what can we do besides what we're doing today to ensure that government is attending to these matters, no matter who is in government, no matter who holds government, in a timely fashion?
Mr. LaPointe?
I'm glad you brought that up. Because I do actually, on the basis of discussions we've had over the years in this chamber, you know, I do have some suggestions that I've pulled out of those discussions that I put in a letter to you that you should have in your hands. And I would like to discuss some of those improvements. I believe we're on the agenda for later in the meeting, and see if there's some things that this committee can do, simple things that might have an impact on this area.
Okay, well, I'll await that later in the meeting then. I'm going to move on to one of the chapters that was covered, and that was travel and expense claims for agencies, boards, and commissions. And, I guess it's quite possible that everything has been done above board, but when the proof or the background for expense claims doesn't exist, we don't know for sure. On page 84, there's a table that shows the number of inadequate documentation for expenses. Can you give us some indication of how many items were tested for each of the entities?
Yes, I'll ask Mr. Spicer to speak to that.
Mr. Spicer?
I can tell you how many individuals we looked at each entity, but the number would differ depending on how much travel those individuals did. So typically what we did at each entity, we would have looked at three individuals from the senior management and board group. At the Nova Scotia Liquor Corp, we would have looked at five individuals. They're a much bigger organization. And there would have been hundreds of claims looked at it, but it would have differed by each entity. I don't have the specific number of claims sort of at each entity with me now. I can supply that if it's required, but so it really did differ, but it would have been literally Hundreds.
Hundreds.
At each entity. And by each claim, we mean each individual. It may have been done monthly, but there may have been like 15 or 20 things claimed on a monthly claim. So each one of those 20 things is what we're considering a claim here, because it could have been done monthly, could have been done on the particular day, depending on what process they had in place. So.
Is there any appearance that people were filing these claims and didn't really understand the need to document everything that they were claiming? Or is it a matter of them not understanding how to fill out the claim form, or is it a matter of just maybe being sloppy and not filling it out as it should be filled out? Or did you have any observations around that?
I think it was probably sloppiness. I think the fact that it's done sometimes and not other times would suggest that they knew that it should be done. I would characterize it probably as sloppiness would be the way I would.
Okay. At the NSLC, there were 21 claims with no evidence of payment. How can we be sure that these items have even been purchased? Is there any physical evidence that an item was purchased and it's still there? Maybe it shows up in an asset inventory, or if it was a personal expense, I mean, they don't think they're really buying physical assets. So,
and these would be all items. Vast majority would be travel and other related expense. So there wouldn't be inventory items, as an example, mm-hmm. included in this. But there would be cases where there would be no receipt provided. Now, specifically at the Nova Scotia Liquor Corp, we would have had identified 19 claims where there would have been no receipt provided. There would have been 21 claims where there was no evidence of payment. So that might have been a case where there may have been a meal with a receipt, but there would be no evidence that it was actually paid. So I guess one of the risks would be that several people put the same receipt in and there's no evidence that it was actually paid for by the person that was claiming it. So that would, there would have been 20, and that would have, those would have been similar issues found in some of the other entities as well. And then the no detailed support. So that would be a credit card slip for a restaurant, but there would have been no detail as to what was actually purchased as far as alcohol, as an example, and those types of things. And then the purpose of the expenditure not noted in many of them as well. So it would be unclear whether the trip or the item being purchased would have been for business purposes. So there wouldn't have been evidence of that. So that would have been the...
Sure. Where there was no purpose noted, and I appreciate it's difficult to know because sometimes there could be business meetings in the evening. But did you notice anything out of the ordinary there? Were there potentially ones that were there expenses that were being claimed with no purpose noted that were, say, in the evening outside of business hours?
Overall, there was nothing particularly unusual about the items being purchased, other than they lacked the appropriate documentation that we would expect to have seen.
Sure. And you'd mentioned the no details reported. That was essentially ones where Visa slips were. And I know if you go to a restaurant, oftentimes you get the bill. It's just the Visa portion, and sometimes they don't give you the itemized receipt. So, but I guess it's a lesson for people to ask for the itemized receipt and ensure that it's included in the future. Was there any information or any comment made to you while you were conducting the audit around these expenses? Any reasons given to you verbally for why there was so many omissions and errors in the way the expenses were calculated?
Now, are you asking about the Liquor Corp specifically?
Yes.
Or just all of them generally?
Generally.
Generally. No, I think it was just sloppiness. Nothing came to our attention that would suggest it was anything other than sloppy, sloppy documentation and processing.
Sure. In recommendation 5.7, there's some suggestion that spouses or partners may have been accompanying traveling employees. Did you find any evidence of that?
There was at the NSLC, there was the process that they do there would be if a spouse was to accompany a one of the senior people on a trip, the administrative assistant would book the travel together because it was just easier to do it that way. And then what would happen would be the individual would then repay the personal the spousal amount, and we did audit work to determine that that was happening. Although there was instances where it was missed, and again we identified those as some cases where the costs that are associated with the spouse traveling was not identified and reimbursed by the individual.
Okay, thank you. There was. Did you see any connection between an increase in administrative expenses at the NSLC related to the volume of liquor sold in the last number of years? Because it seems the administration of costs have gone up more than, I guess, more than you would expect given the volume of alcohol sold over the past number of years. Did you see any connection between the expenses claimed here as being responsible for those increases in the administrative costs?
We wouldn't have looked at that. This audit was particularly looking at the processes around travel claims and other expenses.
Okay. If I might move on to another department, the Transportation Mechanical Branch Management. There was, and I know I'd mentioned this in the in our meeting in camera last week about another division in government where it was recently brought to the attention of my office by a constituent that they were alleging that there was theft of some supplies by employees of the division. I guess what you've raised here is that there is the potential that if there's not strict inventory control in departments, in this case transportation, you could have a risk of theft. And this is not something you'd expect to see in a private organization, because I think they'd be very much on top of that. But have you found evidence of sort of a culture or a mindset that, well, nobody's really watching what our inventory is here, and even with the management, is there a culture that, you know, we're not really held to account for this, so we're not, and I don't want to say people are dishonest, because I think most people, given the benefit of the doubt, are honest people, and they wouldn't want to see theft, no matter where they work. But is there a culture that may be a bit lax that you've noticed when you were reviewing this particular entity that would suggest that they may not be as concerned about managing the inventory as you might find in an organization where they'd be held really to stronger account for that?
Mr. LaPointe?
I would say that I would characterize it a little more strongly than a bit lax. What we found is a culture that accepts a very, very poor level of control and very inadequate process in the management of these in effect garages. And the because of the extensive low level of control throughout the operation, not just inventory and supply management, but you know the management of repairs and the management of preventive maintenance and all of the paperwork, it is it leads to a very high risk of theft, simply because it opens the door to temptation and just to error, even things even getting lost, so that the culture of control in these organizations needs to be strengthened considerably in order to prevent this.
Thank you. And I guess When I was studying at St. Evex, and one of the business courses I took was around corporate culture, and I never really appreciated the value of it at the time, but as I've gotten older, I've noticed how significant it can be and within an organization. And a lot of times, and I don't think just within government, I think right around the province, a lot of people see government as it's not their money, but really it is our money, and we need to make sure that we're protecting it, we're respecting it, because we're all paying for it. And I think there is a bit of a culture that's, and you've identified it within this entity, that there's not really a respect for that money that's coming in from people around the province who are paying their taxes. And I want to ask you, what would the value of the assets be that just in that one entity alone, roughly, that would be at risk of in the case of physical assets like tools and whatnot, that could be at risk of theft and of poor maintenance practices that aren't appreciating the importance of conducting efficient maintenance work to protect assets. What would you say the rough value of just within that entity is that is at risk, dollars that are at risk because of the culture and the lack of oversight?
I'll ask Mr. Spicer to address that.
Mr. Spicer?
Thank you. Just as an example, the report highlights that all of the provincial branches have $6 million at year-end in 2012, there was $6 million of inventory items there. So these range from large dollar tires and all of the parts and stuff you would need to. So that's a picture at year-end. Staff there also indicated that they spent $25 million to repair and maintain approximately 1,000 vehicles during the year. So there's inventory being purchased and consumed throughout the year as well. So,
order, please. Unfortunately, Mr. McMaster's time's expired. Mr. McKinnon.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I would like to jump to Chapter 4. I have been in the House for 7 years, and one of my primary concerns has been transportation and infrastructure renewal. As a rural MLA, with Pictou East having 931 kilometers of rural roads, it's a primary concern for me. I've been an advocate for more dollars, and I certainly am an advocate for every dollar being spent wisely, so that we can do more roads. And we actually inherited a structural deficit, a work deficit. The Road Builders Association of Nova Scotia has said for many, many years that you have to spend at least $400 million a year to even do a dent in what needs to be done in this province, because we needed several billion dollars to bring the roads up to the level that they should be in this province. And with budgets over the years that were in fact less than $200 million, and in the old system of days gone by, there would be sort of flat budgets for 3 years, and then the election year there would be a jump in those budgets. And fortunately, we've had some budgets that were the highest in the history of the province and getting close to the $400 million mark. And this, in fact, is the lowest allocation since forming government. So we've gotten away from that pattern of flat election year going up. I understand that the department is taking your recommendations very, very seriously and has in fact come up with an audit team to implement that made some changes within the department to look after dealing with the recommendations that you have come forward with. So there is an attitude in the department of taking very, very seriously the recommendations. What are your thoughts? Will this audit team be effective, do you believe, in coming forward with the recommendations that you want to see implemented?
Mr. LaPointe?
In a timely fashion.
Yes, well, I have to say that we had discussions with the Deputy Minister and his senior people on this, and the department's response to this audit has been commendable. I have to hand it to them. They jumped right on it. They met with us. They committed to resolving all the issues that we pointed out, and they had some discussions with us. Looking at clarification, looking at advice on how to do things. So that what I would say at this point, I may try and predict the future, but I would say that the department's evident commitment to doing something about this is very high.
I understand that already 30% or 12 out of 38 recommendations have in fact been addressed. Is this in line with your expectations?
Well, that would actually be ahead of our normal expectations to have that high level done before we actually issue the report. But that backs up what I was saying before about the level of commitment. Now, we haven't, of course, verified this, but I know the department has said that they have been working on it and have been implementing some as we speak.
So that, in fact, would be above the norm in relationship to implementation over many years?
Yes, it would.
And who implemented these timely changes? I understand it was at a very high level within the department. This hasn't been sloughed off to some underlings.
No, this commitment to this appears to be at the senior management level in the department, which is really where it has to be for this level of change.
And when will you follow up in checking the number of recommendations that have been implemented?
Our normal follow-up for all these audits is 2 years later, and we definitely will do that.
So you haven't already looked at the 12 that have been implemented, but you've had discussions with the Deputy Minister and others within the department?
Yes, we have. We always meet with the deputies prior to issuing the report to have a discussion with them about it and answer their questions prior to it going public and coming to the House. And we did that and had quite an extensive discussion with them at that time.
Well, I certainly appreciate the work that you have done in relationship to TIR, because TIR is very important to the constituencies that rural MLAs represent. And I personally, and I know others on both sides of the House, feel very, very strongly that our roads have to be maintained in a better fashion than they have been for many years. Some of the roads in the constituency that I represent, I don't say my constituency because it's the people's constituency, but the roads, some of them were paved back in the 70s and 80s, and absolutely nothing done since that time on some of those roads. And I just find it appalling. And sometimes in the worst time to be a rural MLA is in the spring when the potholes come out on the 931 kilometers in Victo East, or a good portion of them. We have paved many of them, and in fact there are five projects underway in Pictou East this year, so I'm very thankful for that. So you've seen that there are changes. You have met with the department since the audit, and was that meeting helpful?
Yes, it was. I think these meetings ideally are mutually helpful, and that we are able to honestly discuss the report with senior management, particularly with the Deputy Minister, who is the CEO in charge. And this particular meeting, I think, was quite beneficial both ways.
Thank you, and I always commend you for the work that you're doing. Sometimes it's a little painful, but we do, in fact, appreciate what you do. Thank you very much. That's all the questioning I have, and I will turn it over to Mr. Ramey.
Mr. Ramey.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I just have a couple of questions I may be handing off as well, but I guess the first one is we've been talking about compliance and all that sort of thing. What mechanism was in place to track recommendations before the province committed to reporting on its response in 2010? What was there before that?
I would say that a few years ago, there was, in fact, no mechanism for tracking. But as a result of discussions with us and our recommendations on this, the government did institute this a process called Tracking Auditor General Recommendations, which is a so-called tagger system, and did put that in place, which is in order to obtain that information from the departments in a central place on a regular basis.
Okay, so so prior to that, there was no tracking mechanism?
No.
And I know sometimes I've looked at recommendations and they go back, you know, they go way back, some. Mm-hmm. In those particular cases, the only way to do follow up on that would have been through public accounts where the Auditor General would have brought it. Perhaps brought this forward again and said, I made a recommendation in, I don't know, 1993, mm-hmm. It's 1997, it's 2001, it still hasn't been done. Why hasn't it been done? Is that the way it would be followed up on, sort of?
Yes, and in fact, because we have to limit the resources we put on that process, as we discussed earlier, because these are resources taken from our audit work. So we tend to focus on at least the one follow-up of recommendations made 2 years ago. Now, we did add a more extensive follow-up going back about 5 years to track what was going on a longer-term basis, but we have to cut that back a certain point, too. We can't keep going back forever, so we
sure.
do not keep tracking what was done in recommendations in 2000 and 2001 and 2002. We go back a certain amount of time, and then we have to stop. And this year we stopped at 2007, and we no longer will track those. Next year we have to look again, and we may have to shrink it down a little bit further.
Mm-hmm.
But we again look at what has been stated as being complete. That's what we look at.
Understood. Okay.
Yeah.
The other question I have relates to, again, compliance with a recommendation. If you, for instance, make a recommendation that has, let's say, several parts to it, I suppose that could happen. You know, there's this, and this. And some of it becomes complied with, and some of it doesn't, or some of it isn't finished yet. Is it correct to assume then that that is incomplete till every part of the recommendation is complete, or is it considered completed if 50% of the recommendation is completed? I'm just trying to figure out how that works.
No, complete in a case means that the entire recommendation has been implemented. We do try to not have multi-part recommendations for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we did used to more so and realize that it's a little counterproductive. So for the most part, we try to, if we have multiple recommendations, we try to just phrase it as, you know, one, two, three separate ones so they can be tracked separately. That's our standard practice now.
Okay. And the other question I would have is there are instances, I believe, and I think this was discussed earlier, where a department states that a recommendation has been completed, but your office disagrees with whether or not that's indeed the case. And so when that happens, Like, what particular evidence do you look for to determine that?
Certainly, I'll ask Mr. Spicer to talk about that.
Mr. Spicer?
Thank you. It would really depend on the recommendation, obviously, but we will look at whatever supporting documentation that let's say if the recommendation, I'll give you an example, was to create and implement a policy, we would see, well, where we would look at the documentation, well, what is the policy, has it been created, and then we may do some testing to see, well, has it in fact been implemented. So that would be an example. So we will interview staff, we will look at supporting documentation, whatever that might be, that would give us an idea that it's been done. And again, it really depends on the recommendation as to what you would need to look at. So it's a little over the map, but we would definitely look at whatever we needed to look at to get some comfort that was in fact implemented.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. And that's it for me, Mr. Chair. I'll turn over, with your permission, to Mr. Wynott.
Mr. Wynott.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. How long do we have?
You have till 10:05.
10:05. Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I want to focus a little bit on the ABCs, just for my own reasons. I am the chair of the Human Resources Committee, so this does have a little bit of interest for me. Agencies, boards, and commissions play an integral role in how government functions, and I think it's important that this audit was done, and this particular chapter was noted as an example where obviously some mistakes were made, and that we should do our best to clean it up. I just want to note for the record, that Film Nova Scotia, the Hants Development Authority, Novacor, the Liquor Corp, Nova Scotia Primary Forest Products Marketing Board, the Strait Highlands Regional Development Agency, Sydney Tarpons, and the Waterfront Development Corp were all looked at in this regard. First of all, I just wanted to ask a question around, just in general, do you know the... what is the record of the Department of Finance when it comes to acting on the AG's recommendations?
Mr. LaPointe?
Now, the Department of Finance, specifically, I don't think I could give you a record over the years, but there have been, we've had some recommendations that they've acted on, some not. But I can't tell you what percentage at this point are complete, though. I don't think I have that in front of me.
Sure. I think it's important to note that all of the sort of recommendations. My understanding is from reading the report is that all of the relevant departments that oversee these different ABCs have said that they will put the proper controls in place. Is that correct?
All of the particular agencies that we audited did agree with our recommendations and said yes, that they would put in the controls that were necessary.
And are these seem to be simple things that could probably be implemented pretty quick?
Yeah, I think that they are. I think that the normal controls and processes for managing expense claims are pretty standard. They're pretty simple, and there's nothing revolutionary in them. So it's really a question of just putting the controls in place. I think they can. All of our recommendations here can be done quickly.
Right, and I think the member for Inverness mentioned something around in the report we read that just visa receipts were submitted and that sort of thing. So it's just a matter of, as the member for Inverness mentioned, it's just a matter of habit now that people should be asking for the itemized receipt and go from there. And I know. As far as MLAs are concerned, those are certainly things that have been implemented over the past number of years. Is that the itemized receipts are being submitted and that sort of thing. So that, I think that's a good thing. How did, in particular, just a quick question around the NSLC? How did they respond to your recommendations?
I'll ask Mr. Spicer to.
Sure. Mr. Spicer.
They responded very well. In fact, they've indicated that they've already implemented all the recommendations.
They've indicated that they've already implemented the recommendations. Okay. You mentioned there was an earlier discussion already in the committee about spouses going on trips with members. Is there any sort of, I know it's to say that it's just easier to book the trip on the same credit card sort of thing, but was there any particular reason why that was done? Or just for convenience purposes? Or, I mean, you know, I've... Anyways, if you can respond to that, it just seems odd to me, but...
That's our understanding. If you have an administrative assistant booking your travel, then book two flights and at the same time, and then it's just easier to do it that way. And so that's our understanding of why it was being done that way. And there was a reimbursement process, but there were some errors made in identifying items that should have been reimbursed.
So these are senior management people?
Yes.
So I assume they would have a corporate credit card, is that?
There would be a corporate, the individual would have a corporate credit card, as well as the administrative assistant would have a corporate credit card, just for those reasons.
Sure.
Yeah.
So you could essentially, instead of using the corporate credit card, you use your personal one and submit the receipt for...
And I believe that's what's going to be happening in the future.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I think that's all the questions I have for right now.
Okay. Mrs. Reagan, we have 15 minutes.
thank you. In your letter that you gave to the committee on May 17th, you suggested that the Government Audit Committee should have the responsibility for ongoing monitoring and implementation of recommendations. I'm just wondering if you could outline for us what's the makeup of this committee and to whom do they currently report?
Mr. LaPointe?
Yes, this is the actually called the Deputy Minister's Audit Committee, which used to be a subset, literally a committee of the Deputies Council, but now consists of all of the Deputy Ministers who meet on a regular basis. They simply constitute themselves as being, you know, in a certain point as of now, not a committee, and deal with all audit issues. Their primary role is to oversee the Internal Audit Division and their work. But it's constituted all the deputy ministers, so in effect they report, you know, to themselves or to David Arrow.
And so that makes sense, because they're the people who are supposed to have final authority over implementation. So
exactly.
It makes sense.
Exactly. They are in effect the CEOs of the organizations, of their departments. So they are the ones in charge, and they have ultimate responsibility for all of these issues that we've been discussing about implementation today.
I'd like to go back to... I just wanted to clarify that, because
sure.
I wasn't clear on that from our conversation earlier. So I'd like to go back to community services. And we were discussing manuals when we last finished up. In terms of manuals, you found some inconsistencies and confusion over interpretation. And I'm just wondering, are you aware of, or did you find during the course of your discussions, instances of staff coming back to senior management, or senior management bringing concerns to the minister about confusion and lack of consistency there?
Yes, I'll ask Ms. Coleman-Saad to speak to that, please.
Coleman-Saad.
Thank you. Anecdotally, we don't have any instances of staff necessarily going to senior management or senior management going to the minister that we are aware of. I would say one of the issues in terms of confusion, though, is that some senior management at the department stated quite clearly that they were very confident staff were not confused by policies in the manual, whereas staff out in the field were telling us that they do find parts of the manual ambiguous and confusing. So I think there's a bit of a disconnect in some instances between how senior management perhaps view the application of the policies and the actual staff out in the field trying to apply the policies.
So do you think the issue is that, you know, these manuals are going out into field and people are expected to read them and know them, or changes are coming along and they're expected to absorb those, and maybe that isn't happening?
I'm not sure whether that is a factor or not. I do think that the manuals are not clear in some instances. For example, there's the 21 days to start a lower risk category investigation into an allegation of abuse or neglect. In some parts of the manual, it says 21 days. In other areas, it says 21 working days. Some people interpret working days as every day of the week because, in theory, there could be an emergency removal of a child on a weekend. Yeah. Others interpret working days as Monday to Friday.
Right.
And so it's just not clear from the manual, like, what is a working day, and is it really a working day? Because in some areas, it just says 21 days. Some people take it as calendar days. Some take it as Monday to Friday.
I'm surprised that when something like that is identified, you know, among staff, that that wouldn't have been something that was dealt with, clarified, you know, early on. I don't think that it would require a vast amount of staff time to clarify something, you know, what is a working day versus... And I mean, really, 21 working days, you go 3 weeks. Whereas if you do Monday to Friday, it's that's 4 weeks in one day. You know, so it seems to me that it would have been very easy for the department to clarify it and would not have expended a huge amount of staff time to deal with that issue before you rolled in there to note that deficiency.
I'm not sure if they were aware of the deficiency.
Okay.
Prior to that or not.
All right. Recommendation 3.4 speaks to the legislative updates to the Act. The department in their response cited what you called a process which does not exist. And I'm just wondering if you could expand on your original concerns with the legislative gaps and your additional concern with their response to this, because I think it says... The department agrees to submit these recommendations for consideration by the government when the Children and Family Service Act is next amended. And I guess that highlights for me the difference between, say, a TIR response, which is, we're on it, to this, which appears to talk about a process that doesn't exist.
Mr. LaPointe.
The department's resistance to this particular recommendation was evident from our first discussions with them, although we were pointing out simply two simple amendments to the legislation. We're not talking about, you know, a major overhaul of the legislation dealing with this. If that, they can do that if they like. We're talking about changing the definition of harm and changing the definition of a child. So if the department's objective, or if the legislation's objective is to safeguard children from harm, mm-hmm. It's good to know what you mean by those words. And those are two what we perceived as significant deficiencies in the current legislation. Well, the response to our recommendation, which was pretty simple, we thought was kind of inadequate because it sort of talked around the issue. And I did discuss this with the Deputy Minister when we discussed these recommendations in the final report. What we wanted to see was that, yes, we will move to change the Act, or no, we won't. And I frankly did not understand what they actually said in their response, because there is no such process to send our recommendations to Cabinet and have Cabinet take it into account the next time they choose to change the Act. That doesn't actually happen. The changes to legislation are initiated by a department and go through the minister of that department. Hmm. There's a process for changing legislation. So we asked them to initiate that process. Now, I believe since then I've heard reports of the minister agreeing to all our recommendations, including that one. So it might be that ultimately they will take action on that. I'm hopeful that they will.
Certainly, we have raised that particular issue in the House, and the minister's response did not indicate to us that it was a priority for them. So that's interesting that you have that perception. Did they indicate to you why it was they were reluctant to change the definition of a child?
No, I didn't come across with any real understanding of what the objection was.
Okay. Thank you. At 3.39, you state that 55% of 134 files with completed investigations, as well as 5 of 6 ongoing investigations, exceeded the department's 6-week guideline. So extending an investigation beyond 6 weeks requires supervisory approval. were those approvals granted in those cases?
I'll ask Ms. Coleman-Sadd to answer that.
Ms. Coleman-Sadd?
So, in those specific instances, I believe we do speak at some point in the report to whether or not supervisory approval was granted for extended investigations. So I can't speak to exactly that 73 number, but I think if you look at paragraphs 3.43, it speaks to 44 of the 78 extended investigations. So I guess the numbers are slightly different. As you move through the testing, sometimes there's different cases or files being taken into account in different areas. But 56% of the 78 had no evidence that the supervisor had approved the extension. And then in some other instances, there was an approval but no rationale for the extension. So about half of the time, there wasn't evidence of supervisory approval.
At what particular level is approval granted? Is it the director level, the manager, or higher? Do you know?
Off the top of my head, I can't speak to the exact staff member in the regional offices, other than that I can say it is out in the regional offices, and it is the staff level that, for example, the social workers would report to. But I can't tell you if that's a director or manager offhand. I'd have to check.
Okay, so we were talking just before this about the rationales for extending an investigation beyond 6 weeks. Are there requirements for rationales to be provided to extend them?
We had an issue with the department with regards to the particular requirement that it be approved for 6 weeks. The department has certain things that they call standards and certain things that they call guidelines. They see their standards as mandatory and their guidelines as not necessarily mandatory. So there is a guideline that an investigation that extends beyond 6 weeks gets supervisory approval. But the manual has a requirement for supervisory approval, and I guess to me, if there's a requirement that your supervisor approves something, it sort of seems like something you're supposed to be doing. We looked at the documentation of a rationale around that approval as a best practice. Like, why do you need to approve this extension? Is it workload? Is it you can't get hold of some of the people you're trying to speak to? Sometimes they have challenges if people are away, or it's a big investigation.
So it seems to me like it's that lack of clarity once again in the manuals, because you have a guideline versus a requirement. It says requirement in the manual, and yet the department says that the 6 week timeline is just a guideline.
Yes, I think it is another good example of where the manual could use some clarification.
Okay. Any idea why so many investigations are exceeding the six-week requirement or slash guideline?
We did look at gaps, and page 39, I believe, the report speaks to sort of length of investigations and then gaps in the extended investigations. I know one reason why investigations can take longer than 6 weeks is that sometimes it is difficult for department staff to contact everybody that they need to. However, on page 39, the charts that speak to the gaps, the extended periods when there was no investigative activity, we excluded those instances where it was obvious from a file that a staff member was trying to contact a particular person or group of people and just were not getting anywhere with getting hold of them. Maybe they're on vacation, they're away. We excluded those from those gaps. So the gaps that we've identified in investigative activity that often do lead to investigations taking longer were gaps where there was just simply no activity.
So, and that you defined that as being a significant factor, I think. Were you surprised to see that there would be, you know, in the cases of child welfare, that you would have these cases where there was no activity for significant periods of time?
I think we expected that if there was no activity, there would be some documentation of why and whatnot. And I do think some of the gaps are quite lengthy. I mean, there are you know, smaller numbers, but some that extended more than 2 months without any activity.
Yeah. So do you have any idea where in some case, whether in some cases those files were just set aside and they weren't working on them for a bit?
So I guess it's obvious to us from the length of the gaps that there definitely was a period when the files were not worked on. As to why that occurred, I think you'd have to speak to the department about that. We wouldn't have that information.
Okay. The department's response to recommendation 3.9 states they will review and possibly modify the requirement. Now, when they're talking about the requirement, they are referring to the 6-week maximum for investigations. Is that correct?
That's my understanding of that.
And by modify, do you have any idea whether this indicates an intention to extend or remove the 6-week requirement? Because it would seem to me that, yes, it would remove the Auditor General from saying, yeah, you're not fulfilling this requirement, but it certainly doesn't help children if you get rid of that.
There was some discussion in our discussion of the draft report around the fact that the department felt perhaps 6 weeks is too short a period, or perhaps there shouldn't be a limit on that.
Order, so. Please. Unfortunately, Ms. Regan's time has expired. Mr. McMaster, you have 15 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to finish off on the chapter on Department of Transportation, Mr. Spicer was clarifying sort of the amount of money that would be at risk because of the lack of oversight of the operations. Could you just finish off on the answer you were providing and maybe start again and just provide an answer on that?
Okay. So in the Mr. Spicer report, it gives you a little idea of the dollars involved. So at March 31st, 2012, inventory held by all the mechanical branches would have been $6 million. So that would have been a picture at a point in time. Of which Miller Lake would have had $4.1 million and Truro $0.6 million, or half a million approximately. During the year, staff indicated that they spent approximately $25 million to repair and maintain approximately 1,000 vehicles to the province. So that would have been parts and supplies that would have been consumed during the year to do what they needed to do. As far as the actual pieces of equipment, some of the pieces of equipment is it's big, expensive graders and loaders and backhoes, which can be six-figure pieces of equipment. And of course, they'd have a number of those. I don't have the dollar value of where they are at now, sure. But it's they're very expensive pieces of equipment.
With respect to preventative maintenance for that equipment, is the equipment lasting as long as it should, or did you find any evidence of neglect of equipment or maybe heavy use of equipment beyond what it should be used for?
What we looked at as far as preventive maintenance go was the required preventive maintenance being done, and the report indicates that it isn't being done. As far as whether the equipment is lasting as long as it should, we didn't look at that. They have indicated that. One of the difficulties they have, I guess, with the equipment there is it operates in difficult climates at times, exposed to some salt and you know your snow plowing and those types of things. So it operates in harsh environments, which I think makes the preventive maintenance even that more important to make sure that that's being done. Mm-hmm. So to answer your question specifically, no, we didn't look at whether it was they were getting the useful life and that they expected out of the equipment.
Okay. And I think plow trucks, I was just asking somebody the other day, they were saying the lifespan is about 10 years, but at that point they're pretty well rusted out, the bodies of them. So, in any case, I think what you've highlighted and what we're highlighting right now is maybe the importance for us to have a closer look at preventative maintenance to ensure that we're getting the value for these pieces of equipment. The next question I have is, I know that the department had said they were in the midst of upgrading their accountability before your report was released. Did you see any evidence that things were happening the changes were being made that would be significant enough to fix the problems that you've highlighted in the report.
Mr. LaPointe.
Mr. Spicer, to keep that discussion.
Mr. Spicer.
Thank you. As Mr. LaPointe had indicated earlier, our meetings with both middle management and senior management at the department were good. They really seem to be taking this very seriously, and we understand have already started to address some of the control weaknesses that they can address immediately. We haven't gone back to verify that, but so through discussions with them, they've also indicated they're in the process, I believe, of getting a new information system that should help with perhaps some of the limitations that the current system may have. So overall, we are encouraged by our discussions with management there.
Okay, I just want to move to Chapter 3 on community services, would you say there is, and I guess getting back to the theme of corporate culture, is there a culture of neglect here where children who are, there's reports of children who are abused, that the response by the department is neglect in the sense that it's taking too long for the abuse to be recognized or to be investigated? Does that have to do with, I mean, there's talk about process and manuals, but what about the humanity of those who are working? Is there a culture there that when people come into work there that gets driven out of them? I don't want to say too much, but I think we have to look at that. Did you notice any evidence of a culture that pervaded the department that was somewhat responsible for the neglect of those children?
Mr. LaPointe.
I would certainly not say that there's any kind of negative culture involved in this. You know, I made those comments about the mechanical branches, but I certainly would not say that here. I might say the opposite, that the program is staffed by social workers who, you know, if you know them, are a highly motivated and caring group of people. Working very hard for probably not enough money, in my view, for what they do. It's a very difficult job, and I see a very high level of commitment in them. But the system they're working with doesn't make it easy for them to do their job. So that if you look at the kind of comments we're making, they have to do with the processes, with the management, with the direction, with the systems in place to support the social workers in doing the job that they're trying to do. So that's where I think the focus has to be in that area.
Did you find that the processes that they have to work with are too complicated, that maybe they could be simplified?
I don't know wouldn't say too complicated, but maybe more in the nature of needs work.
Sorry, can you repeat
they're
that?
More in the nature of the systems that need work, like the manuals we were discussing that are still cumbersome and paper-based and not updated and so on. They simply need to be modernized and to be made more accessible and more up-to-date so that the people who are using them have tools that help them to do their job.
What would you say is the reason for the delays? If you've seen that people are motivated and that they care about the children they're trying to serve, there needs to be some improvements, you say, to the manuals, but there's obviously something causing the delays.
Mm-hmm.
How do we get to the bottom of that, and did you see any areas where it could be improved?
On that one, I will ask Ms. Coleman-Sadd to talk to it.
Ms. Coleman-Sadd.
So the delays that we identified are in different areas. There's delays in terms of monitoring of children once they're in care. There's delays in actual completion of investigations. Anecdotally, we really didn't hear a tremendous amount as to why those might be. The department management did make some comments regarding prioritization, for example, when visiting children who are in care and whatnot, that workers may prioritize, you know, which children they visit first, perhaps newer foster families, those types of things. But really not a whole lot anecdotally or in the files from staff regarding the reasons for those delays.
So we don't really know why there's delays?
No, I would say that it's not evident from the files why there are delays, and that anecdotally from workers, there wasn't a huge amount of information coming to us to indicate why there would be delays. With regards to some of the 30-day contacts with foster children, I believe there was a little bit of confusion. I can't recall if it was with regards to the contacts with children or the contacts with foster parents of whether or not it should be in person or if a phone call was acceptable. Mm-hmm. The manual does say it should be in person, and I think some staff might have been contacting via the phone in some instances, but I don't think that necessarily accounts for all of what we would have identified as delays in those 30-day contacts.
I guess it seems strange to me that we've identified something that's very important if we're trying to protect these children. And the last thing we want to do is victimize them again through a bad government process. What is planned for follow-up to try to fix this matter? Is there going to be further discussion with the department, or is it just going to stop here? Are we going to rely on maybe the public awareness of the issue to put pressure on the government to fix the problem? Or I'll let you comment.
Yeah,
Mr. LaPointe.
The way this process is working right now is that we identify these deficiencies, we propose these solutions, and then we pull away from it at that point until we just go back 2 years later to do a review of what has happened at that point. But it's not our role then to try and work with management to make those changes. We're not part of the management team, and that would be improper, so that it becomes solely up to the individual department and their management to take whatever action they think is necessary. So basically we make the recommendations and then it's over to management.
Okay, but for this specific matter, there's no specific recommendation that you'd have to fix the problem?
Well, the individual recommendations, we feel, together should move the department towards addressing their problems. They will. If some things that we've identified, like the gaps in monitoring and so on, don't have an clearly evident reason for existing, then it's up to the department, and they're seeking the solutions to eliminate those gaps. Obviously to find what's causing them and find ways around them. So it leaves it in their hands to deal with that. But I believe we have enough solutions to the various individual problems that we've identified that lead them a long way to tightening up what they're doing.
Sure, and I know you have some other recommendations today for mm-hmm. how this committee can operate to
yes.
ensure that departments are more responsive. If we look at the overall performance of the departments with respect to the recommendations you're putting forth to them. When you have to spend this amount of time revisiting and checking up on departments to ensure that recommendations are being implemented, what kind of time is that, or what kind of resources is that tying up from your office that then limits you from doing further audit work?
Well, it's without having, you know, precise hours in front of me, I'd say that it's easily equivalent to another audit. And we can certainly never entirely eliminate it, but I'd certainly like to be able to be in a position of reducing the necessity of our office doing this amount of follow-up. I think we'll always need to have a hand in this and always need to be going back. This is a matter of due diligence. But right now it's pretty time-consuming.
And what have you seen from departments generally? Are they open to your recommendations generally? And I guess maybe I should specify the ones that are the 41% of recommendations that haven't been followed through on. Are you seeing sort of resistance by departments that they see the Auditor General's office as somebody they don't want to see knocking at their door? Or Are they? Can you give any comment about that?
Well, I wouldn't say that people are always thrilled to see us knocking at their door. But I would say that we see, as a general rule, resistance to what we find. There are cases in which an agency or a department or a group within them, will see us as just being overly critical and be resistance to us trying to change what's going on. That's probably the exception to the norm. On the other side, we have some who see us as being a force for helping them to better manage their departments, which I guess we're seeing here as an example in TIR. So the reactions are pretty mixed, but as a general rule, it's not a resistance to what we have to say. By the time we're finished auditing, by the time we're finished discussing and reviewing with management what we find, as a general rule, the norm is that they agree with what we say and appear to be motivated to taking action. It's what happens subsequently which is questionable.
I guess then it becomes a management issue because it's implementing the recommendations.
Yes.
What role do cabinet ministers play in this? Are they to be looked at as...
Order, please. Unfortunately, your time has expired. Mr. Epstein.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I just wanted to thank the Auditor General and his staff for their ongoing work for this report in particular. I wanted to assure him and the public that this report is being very closely read inside the government departments specifically named and in the government generally. It will form part of the basis for ongoing administrative improvements and for the government's commitment to greater openness and accountability. I wanted to thank him again. We actually have no more questions. Thank you.
No more questions? Okay, thank you very much. We have some items on our agenda that we have to look at today, and one of them is the letter from the Office of the Auditor General, and was brought forward in the in-camera meeting. It was suggested that the caucuses have a look at the comments from the Auditor General, and with that, I'd ask the Auditor General for any comments, further comments he has on this letter that was dated May the 17th.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I did on May 17th forward to this committee a letter with some suggestions as to some actions that the committee can take that can assist in getting a better result in terms of the implementation of recommendations from our reports. These all followed from discussions that we've had either in the committee or in subcommittee discussions we've had with CCF when they've appeared here as well, and build on the best practices they've identified. So I've made some suggestions here for the committee to consider, and what I'd like to suggest for the committee today is three things that I would like you to consider. And the first is to accept and approve the letter of May 17 and the recommendations it makes. And secondly, if that is done, then to, as a committee, formally accept and endorse all the recommendations in the spring report, except for any that might not have been accepted by a department or agency, which I don't believe that we have any this time, and then ask that the departments and agencies take responsibility to ensure timely timely implementation of recommendations. And then, as a third request, that the committee ask the Deputy Minister's Audit Committee to assume responsibility for ongoing monitoring and oversight of implementation of the Auditor General's recommendations and take a proactive role in promoting full and timely implementation, which was the first two proposals that we had in the letter. I think our third proposal can probably wait a future discussion for later meetings of the committee.
Yes, Mr. Epstein?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. The May 17th letter actually, I think, first came to our attention at the in-camera meeting 1 week ago. Since that time, we haven't had a chance to meet as a caucus. We anticipate meeting next week in retreat, although there's a full agenda for it. I'm not sure if we'll get the chance to discuss it, but the main point is that we have received the letter, which has now been made public today, but have not yet had the chance to discuss it with our full caucus. I'm not sure if the other caucuses have had the chance to discuss it, and therefore I think we're not in a position yet to adopt or reject or modify any of the suggestions made in it. Obviously, what we've just heard from the Auditor General is a suggestion for a course of action that is based on acceptance of the letter. I'm not rejecting the letter. I'm just saying we haven't had the chance to discuss it fully in our caucus yet. And so I'm just suggesting that the status of the letter should be as we discussed in camera last week, which is it I think should be referred to all the caucuses for comment, and we should come back and have a chance to discuss how, as a committee, we're going to proceed with it. And at that point, we can turn to the specific proposals that we've just heard this morning. I'd like to hear from my colleagues.
Mr. McMaster.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And from reading the letter, to me, I take it as something that's constructive, that will improve the kinds of things that we're seeing in your recent report that show recommendations that aren't being implemented. I think we're all here to make the province a better place. I think the points that you make in the letter create greater accountability to make our province and our government work better and more efficiently, and that's ultimately what our job is as representatives, elected representatives. So I am okay with the letter. I'd be supportive of it today, and I think we should show leadership and support this and move ahead with it.
Ms. Regan, sorry about that. Ms. Regan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Liberal Caucus also would like to support this letter. We agree that the recommendations made by the Auditor General are appropriate, and for that reason, we would like to move ahead with the vote.
Okay. Mr. Epstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I said, we simply haven't had the chance to discuss it at caucus, and I thought that was really the proposal that was accepted unanimously at our in-camera meeting. But given the comments of my colleagues, I'll move that we table the letter and undertake, along with that we as a caucus will get back to the committee as soon as we can. But I move that we table the letter for now.
Ms. Regan?
I have a concern with as soon as we can. When we leave open-ended timelines, things can not happen as a result. So all the caucuses went away last week knowing that that the Auditor General would be here today, that it would be an appropriate time and place to deal with these recommendations. And to say that you have not been able to meet with your caucuses in this day and age where there's email, where there's telephone, you could
order,
have...
Order, please. Order. Order. Ms. Regan has the floor.
Nonetheless, the other two caucuses have managed to come up with a position on it, and you had to know that the Auditor General would be here today and that he would most likely ask that this letter be approved at that time. So to suggest that you haven't had a chance to meet when, in fact, 7 days have passed, to me seems rather odd.
Mr. McMaster?
No, I guess I've said what I've said. I don't see anything in this letter that alarms me. I recognize that should the caucus that I am with have the good fortune of being in government someday, I would welcome the suggestions that are here, and I have no problem putting that on the record today. So you know where I stand.
Mr. Epstein, would you any more comments?
Well, there was nothing odd. We just didn't have a caucus meeting last Wednesday as we normally would. That's all. But time for the question. Question.
Mr. Epstein, would you like to restate your motion?
Thank you. Yes, the motion just was to table the letter.
Recorded vote.
Yes, record vote's been called for. Start All those in favor say aye and a nay, of course, when you record it. We'll start with Mr. Ramey.
Aye.
Mr. Wynot?
Yes.
Mr. Prest?
Yes.
Mr. McKinnon?
Yes.
Mr. Epstein?
Aye.
Ms. Regan?
No.
Ms. McMaster?
No.
And my vote is no. The motion is carried, majority, and we will look forward to the time when the caucuses come back with this information. Hopefully it's soon. Next, we have a couple of other things here. The Auditor General has tabled his general business plan for 2013-14, which you've all received today. There will be no committee meeting next week, June the 5th, due to an out-of-town caucus by the NDP. And there will be an in-camera briefing at 11 today regarding the Trade Center. And Mr. McMaster has requested to Mr. LaPointe some questions around the agency's boards and commissions expenses, and the clerk will send a detailed letter exactly what was promised there by Mr. Spicer, I believe. And if there's no other business, and hopefully I've got everything here today, again, it'll be an in-camera briefing immediately following this meeting. So an order, motion to adjourn will be in order. So, Mr. McKinnon, we stand adjourned. Thank you.